Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening once again. It's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, and we've got a wonderful show for you tonight. Tonight's show, we've got excerpts from a speech by Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia, the great physicist and friend of Albert Einstein, Ernest Sternglass, who warns us about the dangers of nuclear power and how we might mitigate it. We've got the special guest on turtle life, turtle safety, Stacey Lee Sherwood. We've got Michelle McKenzie Esquire, who's going to talk about human rights. We've got an excerpt of some comments of Bill McKibben on the status of the XL pipeline. And we've got Robert Reich, who does, in 2 minutes, explain the entire economy. And then our last guest, Mr. David Hoffman, but more about that in a minute. This is a special PNN talking not just about human rights, but about the human rights to live, the human right to have an environment around us that isn't dying, that isn't poison, the human right to communicate. I think you're going to like tonight's show. Again, Progressive News Network, I'm your host, Rick Spezak, and now the news. To heal Florida Springs, hold polluters accountable. Oh my God, what a concept. To anyone who has spent much time in Florida, the decline of our freshwater springs is heartbreaking. Clear pools are now choked with algae. The algae gets so thick it shuts down glass bottom boat rides because the water is no longer clear enough to see anything. Swimming beaches at the springs are suddenly roped off with health department signs. Water toxic to even touch. When faced with something this sad and overwhelming, there's a tendency to shrug our shoulders and say, well, it's the inevitable result of progress. The truth is that the springs pollution is both preventable and reversible. We can change this. What we need is political will, a scarce Florida resource, but one that each of us can cultivate. It's already starting to happen. People have been rallying throughout the state to protest the decline of our water resources. Recently, people turned out in force to demand clean water at public events in Boynton Beach, Bradenton, Fort Myers, Fort Pierce, Gainesville, Interlochen, Jacksonville, Key West, Palm Bay, Naples, Ocala, Stuart, Tallahassee, Tampa, Vero Beach, and Orlando. They unveiled a new Florida Clean Water Declaration, which lists six rights that should be guaranteed to the people of Florida and the four responsibilities of our state government: water managers, and natural resource users. The campaign goal is to get as many individuals, organizations, businesses, and elected and appointed officials as possible to sign the Clean Water Declaration. Even more important, Simmons and Stewart are spearheading the important legislation in the State House this year to protect the springs, and they deserve our support. It's encouraging, too, to see that even Governor Rick Scott earmarked $55 million in his proposed state budget this year for springs protection. But using state money to protect our shared resources makes sense. We're long overdue on fixing our outdated public infrastructure. But let's not lose sight of the main thing we need to do. Demand that our leaders hold the polluters accountable. Every day, factory farms send fertilizers and manure into our public waters. Scott's administration adopted weak language, and the legislation improved it. Last year, some lawmakers proposed a common sense amendment for the state to collect reports of skin rashes and health effects from this pollution, but the legislature overwhelmingly and unbelievably voted it down. Scott's administration also fired staffers who dared to enforce environmental laws, replacing them with people who came from the polluting industries. And all we can really say to that is... That's roll out the barrel, in case you didn't recognize it. The EU has a secret plan for police to be able to remote stop cars next year. The European Union is secretly developing a remote stopping device to be fitted into all cars that would allow the police to disable vehicles at the flick of a switch from a control room. Confidential documents from a committee of senior EU police officers who hold their meetings in secret have set out a plan entitled Remote Stopping Vehicles as part of a wider law enforcement surveillance and tracking measure. These devices, which could be in all new cars by the end of the decade, would be activated by a police officer working from a computer screen at its central headquarters. As always, if you go to AveryVoice.com, AveryVoice.com, you can get all the details of the stories that I'm going to be introducing. Persona not polluta. The anti-fracking activist has been banned from 312.5 square miles of Pennsylvania. Vera Scroggins, an outspoken opponent of fracking, has been legally barred from the new county hospital. Also off limits, unless Scroggins wants to risk fines and arrest, is a restaurant where she takes her grandchildren, the supermarket where she shops, the animal shelter where she adopted her Yorkshire Terrier, recycling center, and lakeshore. In total, 312.5 square miles are no-go areas for Scroggins under a sweeping court ruling granted by a local judge that bars her from any properties owned or leased by one of the biggest drillers in Pennsylvania, National Gas Rush, Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation. How about that? On another front where they roll out the barrel, Fukushima fallout damages the thyroids of California babies. This by Chris Busby. A new study of the effects of tiny quantities of radiation fallout from Fukushima on the health of babies born in California shows a significant excess of hyperthyroidism caused by the radioactive contamination traveling 5,000 miles across the Pacific. The article will be published next week in the peer-reviewed Open Journal of Pediatrics. Congenital hypothyroidism is a rare but serious condition, normally affecting about one child in 2,000, one that demands clinical intervention. The growth of children suffering from this condition is affected if they are left untreated. All babies born in California are monitored at birth for thyroid-stimulating hormone levels in the blood, since high levels indicate hyperthyroidism. Joe Magano and Jeanette Sherman of the Radiation and Public Health Project in New York and Christopher Busby, guest researcher at Jacobs University, Bremen, examined congenital hyperthyroidism rates in newborns using data obtained from the state of California over the period of the Fukushima exposures. Their results are published in their paper, Changes in Confirmed Plus Borderline Cases of Congenital Hyperthyroidism in California as a Function of Environmental Fallout from the Fukushima Nuclear Radiation. Researchers compared data for babies exposed to radioactive iodine-131 born between March 17th and December 31st, 2011, with unexposed babies born in 2011 before the exposures, plus those born in 2012. Confirmed cases of hyperthyroidism, defined as those with TSH levels greater than 29 units, increased by 21% in the group of babies exposed to excessive radioactive iodine in the womb. The same group of children had a 27% increase in borderline cases. Contrary to many reports, explosion of the reactor and spent fuel at Fukushima produced levels of radioactive contamination which were compatible with the Chernobyl releases in comparable with the Chernobyl releases in 1986. Using estimates made by the Norwegian Air Laboratory, it's possible to estimate that more than 250 becquerels, that's 200 by 1015 becquerels of iodine-131, a half-life of 8 days, were released at Fukushima. It's also predicted by comparing the cesium-137 estimates with the iodine-131 releases from Chernobyl, quantities which caused the thyroid cancer epidemic in Belarus, the Ukraine, and parts of the Russian Republic. We will go on with this story later. I do want to continue. Again, you can find the details at averyvoice.com. That's A-V-E-R-Y-V-O-I-C-E.com. Next story I want to cover, environmental radiation from nuclear reactors in Fukushima. It's increasing cancer in southeastern Florida. A special report on the Florida Baby 2 study. Radiation and Public Health Project, March 28, 2001. In an executive summary, operations at four nuclear reactors in southeastern Florida, that's Turkey Point 3 and 4, St. Lucie 1 and 2, have added considerable radioactivity to the local environment, raising concerns over whether local residents have been harmed. The Radiation and Public Health Project research group has investigated these issues and has documented facts that suggest such harm is in fact occurring. A number of these findings have been published in peer-reviewed medical journals. That's radioactivity emissions, environmental levels, in-body levels. From 1970 to 87, Turkey Point and St. Lucie emitted 10.39 trillion picocuries of radioactivity into the air. From 85 to 95, the level of radioactive chemicals in Miami precipitation remained constant, suggesting that a constant source of emissions, nuclear power reactors, were supplementing and offsetting the decay of fallout from old atomic bomb tests. Similarly, concentrations of radioactive strontium-90 in 86 Dade County baby teeth tested by RPHP have been rising since the early 80s. The current level is equal to that of the late 1950s when the U.S. and Soviet Union conducted large-scale nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere. Dade County and other southeastern Florida baby teeth have the highest level of radioactive strontium-90, a known carcinogen, than anywhere in the U.S. where baby teeth have been studied. In addition, the area also has a rate of childhood cancer that is considerably higher than the U.S. average. Okay, let me go on. Again, full details in the Avery Voice site. Extent of Freedom site contamination still unknown. That's our friends and cousins up in West Virginia. Again, roll out the barrel. It's very appropriate. But, of course, while they are rolling out the barrel, discovering new spills, everything's fine. Don't you just worry that pretty little head of yours. Federal investigators remain unsure how much chemical contamination there is in the soil and groundwater at the Freedom Industries tank farm that spilled thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals in the region's Elk River drinking water supply. So far, state and federal government agencies have provided the public with few details about the long-term plans for cleanup of the site, which is just 1.5 miles upstream from the West Virginia American water intake. Officials have not been provided even a description of the process for how long that long-term plan will be developed or how members of the public can learn the details and provide input. I know they're working on a plan right now, said Fran Burns, remedial product manager for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's regional office in Philadelphia. EPA officials made Burns available for an interview to answer the Gazette questions about the extent of contamination on the site, which has been done to control any additional runoff and the long-term prospects for remediation. The State Department of Environmental Protection has not responded to requests for an interview or briefing to address those issues. It's a cover-up. The State Department of Environmental Protection, EPA believes the cleanup crews from the contractor hired by Freedom Industries have taken adequate steps. They didn't mention busting that additional pipe, though, I'm afraid. And as far as the extent of contamination of the spill, the work has been going on at the site has contained anything that spilled, he said, of course. And he barely adjusted the blinders he was wearing. Oh, by the way, just this past Friday, they did close schools because the stench of the licorice smell has been so profound in the kitchens of these schools that the schools have had to be closed. But, of course, everything's okay. Dennis Matlock, the EPA's on-site coordinator, said that he's pretty confident contamination has stopped. One thing they're still working on is the groundwater issue. He said a lot of groundwater is passing under the site. Not that it's taking any of the contamination with it, mind you. It's just the geology or the makeup underneath the tanks. There's got to be a lot of runoff control. Okay, on to the next subject. Officials said odds over safety of the water. A Again, this is West Virginia. We haven't yet talked about the North Carolina issue, but there'll be more on that next week as well. Is the water supply safe? Well, the answers from local, state, and national officials continue to vary. Rahul Gupta, head of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, and Dr. Letitia Tierney, state health officer and commissioner for the State Department of Public Health, appeared Wednesday morning before a joint legislative committee investigating. Later that day, Dr. Tanya Popoff, acting director of the National Center for Environmental Health within the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, spoke at a press conference. Gupta's information goes against what Tierney and Popovic said. Tierney and Popovic also at the Times differed. And after the press conference, Tierney reiterated her position she's provided as much accurate information as she can, whenever it becomes available. Why, if I'd gone into that room on the first day and they told me to lie to cover up, why, I would have quit, said Tierney, referencing officials to the administration of Governor Ray Tomlin. I don't need this job. I quit better paying jobs to take it. I can make more money in the private sector. I don't need it. Sounds like a clear answer on what's going on with the water. Tierney, who has left time to speak during the commission hearing, said she's drinking the water, bathing in it, and otherwise using it. Tomlin said at the same press conference later that day. At the end of the day, people are going to believe what their physician is saying over what the administration is saying, Gupta said. Popovic, who came to Charleston for the day, said during the press conference, she understood the basic question West Virginians want answered. Is your water safe? What I can say is with all scientific evidence that we have, with everything that numerous people have worked on so far, I can say you can use your water however you like it. You can drink it, you can bathe it, why, you can use it however you like. Tomlin said, science suggests that the water's safe, but the state can't say it's safe with 100% of certainty. Well, let's move along here. I do want to play this little comment by Senator Jay Rockefeller on that subject. Here we go. Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia.
By first talking about, we're talking about how people are upset that they don't have the answers that they're looking for. They're still not sure whether or not their water is safe. And just talk a little bit about that and if you feel that it's safe from what you see.
No, I don't. And even if some expert group told me it was safe, I don't think I'd believe it. And I think that's where all of us in West Virginia have reached a level of cynicism about information that we're getting, or in most cases not getting, because CDC and EPA can't tell you long-term effects. They can't, the news spill, they can't tell you all about that. They can say, well, it's not hazardous or this or that, but that doesn't mean anything. If people can't drink water, they can't live. You know, everything else in the economic and social and sort of personal life of West Virginia just disappears if you can't drink water. And they're left in the dark.
Who are the people that we need to be getting these answers from? Who can tell us that it's safe or not?
Well, that always psychologically, that's now imprinted into West Virginia people's mind, so that even if they're told that it is safe, some will refuse to believe that. And maybe with good cause, because who knows if something else isn't happening. Just like there was a second spill, maybe there'll be a third spill or a fourth spill. I find it astounding, absolutely astounding, and it makes me embarrassed for my state, that nobody bothered to check on those tanks since 1991. It may not be a criminal act, but it ought to be. In this case, on the part of the state or the federal government.
Hey, don't worry. It's it's all those regulations, you know. But meanwhile, on another subject again, 3 Kanawha schools close early for water quality issues. This from the Tribune in West Virginia, Charleston. 3 schools in Charleston are closing early this morning due to water quality concerns. Overbrook Elementary will close at noon. Watts Elementary on the west side will close at 11:30, and J.E. Robbins Elementary dismissed students at 10 a.m. Superintendent Ron Daring said the closing of the schools was due to the detection of a licorice smell in the school. It was first reported to J.E. Robbins in the school's kitchen. At Watts, it was also in the kindergarten classroom. At Overbrook, the smell was faint, but in the water at several locations. Daring said the J.E. Robbins cook's eyes were reported burning. Burning eyes and a licorice odor were both indicators of the presence of the crude MCHM, the coal cleaning chemical that spilled into the Elk River on January 9th and has confused scientists ever since. But enough of that. Now we're going to move on to nuclear safety. And I want you to hear this brief interview with Dr. Ernst Steinglass, who will talk about putting nuclear power in perspective.
My name is Ernest Steinglass, and I'm a professor of radiation physics in the School of Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, retired now, but still very active, and I'm on my way to Japan, and I'm stopping off here in California briefly. I'm going on a lecture tour in order to be able to explain the danger of radiation from bomb testing, and more recently from nuclear reactors, and finally from the depleted uranium weapons, tons of which have been used in Iraq and which are now affecting the whole world. And my concern is about the health of people. I'm very concerned that we are totally destroying the future of our nation, and that in recent years the nuclear reactors have been working so hard to push them for the last nickel to come out and get the most electricity and the most money out of them, that they have in fact turned out to replace the bomb fallout that we experienced during the 1950s and 60s. And in fact, bomb testing continued until 1980 in the atmosphere, and most people don't realize it, that our country, U.S., continued underground bomb testing with many times exploding through the ground until 1992. And the last underground test by China didn't take place until 93. And the effects have been hundreds to thousands of times greater than anything we expected on the basis of 100 years worth of knowledge of X-rays. And that's really what's so important, that we vastly underestimated what radiation from fission products, when uranium breaks into two, as it does in the bomb, or it does in a nuclear reactor, that these wastes, which are sometimes let out of the stack, go in and turn out to be so much more serious than anything that we have ever, ever expected. And unless we learn this, we are going to produce a generation of children who are much more handicapped, and who are many ways much more handicapped in ways that we are now learning, that autism and things like low birth weight and childhood cancer and infant mortality have been rising most in the states that have nuclear reactors, but now everywhere, even in the states that have no nuclear reactors, because the depleted uranium particles that were produced when any of these big ammunitions made out of uranium metal hit metal or a rock, they certainly then turn out to produce a very fine particles that act like a gas that go around the world and come down with the rain and snow and get into our diet everywhere and are now causing enormous health care and not just cancer. That's really the important part. And we need to understand, unless we do something about it, we are vastly increasing not only the suffering of people and the death of over 20 million people in this country that have died ever since, above normal expectation, since the nuclear bomb was developed. And now I'm on my way, and I have to talk about this in Japan. I have to talk about it at a conference in Hiroshima, and that will be very difficult because I was in the Navy at the time when the bomb was dropped, and it may have saved my life. And that's really the terrible thing, that only by suffering do human beings learn terrible lessons, just like in the Middle Ages. We didn't realize that unless we had clean water and knew what to do with our sewage, we would create big epidemics of illness. And now we are in a situation where we're doing it with uranium in the wind. And that's the tragedy that has to be brought out, because we cannot survive as a nation by destroying one generation of children and their ability, because that's what the future depends upon, the health of our children. And that's why I'm talking about this subject today. I was born in Berlin, and my parents were physicians. My father was a dermatologist. And he was talking to my mother, who was a gynecologist and pediatrician, over the dinner table when I was a child. And they talked about the danger of x-rays, because my father had to treat children, young people and older people, who had skin cancer. And then he found out that many of them had been treated for acne with x-rays. And so he had to cure their skin cancer. And that's a terrible thing to find out, that people have made great mistakes in the use of radiation, even during the early years of the discovery of x-rays and the discovery of uranium and nuclear fission, which took place in 1938-39, which is about the year I escaped with my family from Hitler's Germany. And we were lucky. But the reason I became so interested in radiation, both from the point of being useful and from the point of view of being very dangerous, is that as a child I used to walk into shoe stores and I used to love to watch and look at my toes through the shoe, because they had x-ray machines in the shoe stores. And this way you could find out whether your shoe fitted or not. And so I learned at the same time the fun and the benefit of x-rays, and of course I also learned the danger of x-rays. And that got me oriented for the rest of my life. And even when I went to college, I became interested in the history of x-rays and the history of radiation and physics and engineering. And finally, I began to, get a degree first in electrical engineering. But my interest has always persisted, because my father encouraged me, my mother, they took me, it took me to the laboratory where the man who invented these yellow sodium vapor lamps on the highway, it was one of his patients. So I became interested in medicine and physics and the danger of x-rays and ultraviolet radiation that my mother used in her office to treat people. And so early in life, I was oriented exactly towards both the benefit and the danger of radiation. But the most important thing happened is that when I was drafted and went into the Navy, just about to be shipped out to the invasion of Japan, when the atomic bomb ended the war. And in a way, tragically it was, but I felt it saved my life. And that is a feeling that is just so conflicting, between feeling good about being alive and being sad about this terrible business of using one bomb to kill 100,000 people at one time. And so we have to learn from our experience. And so I became interested in this whole problem of what can we do to avoid extinguishing the human race with nuclear weapons. And that's what I've dedicated my life to. When I got out of the Navy, and I worked at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory, after a few years, I lost a child. And that got me also to become very concerned about what could happen to a young baby that all of a sudden couldn't sit up and all of a sudden had some kind of defect. And it was not until many years later that we found out it was a disease that was caused by some mutation in some ways back in time. In previous generations, possibly, it was Tay-Sachs disease that both my wife and had the genes for it, and we could never have children. But it made me also know what it means to lose a young child as a baby. And so, with this background, I went back to Cornell and went to graduate school in engineering physics. And I got my degree and my master's and then my PhD at Cornell, using this phenomenon where an electron hits any kind of solid and knocks out more electrons, which is used in the photomultiplier tubes that open doors. When we walk up to a certain door and it automatically opens, there's a light beam that detects our presence, and as a result, the photoelectrons are released, and the secondary electron multiplies it, and it sends a signal to open the door. And that's what we were doing. So I was interested in the application of physics and in practical things, like one was to improve the ability to take X-ray pictures or fluoroscopy with less radiation, because we were using a lot of radiation during fluoroscopy. On a fluorescent screen, you stand there and they look at you for a few minutes maybe, and you get an enormous dose. And so it so happens that I was able to work on a big image intensifier that cut the dose in fluoroscopy by 100 to 200 fold. And that was done at the Westinghouse Research Lab because they heard me give a talk on my work at Cornell. And they asked me to come to work on the research of electron physics for imaging tubes.
So that was Dr. Ernest Sternglass talking about nuclear radiation and some of the issues, positive and negative, about it. While we're waiting for our next guest, come on. I'm going to go ahead and play this quick comment from Bill McKibben talking about the XL pipeline.
So what does it mean that the State Department said last week that it has no major environmental objections to the XL pipeline?
The White House and the State Department especially, I think, would like to approve it because big oil really wants it. They've spent millions of dollars. But their story is unraveling. The idea that it would make no difference is crazy. It's a pipeline that would carry 800,000 barrels of oil in the last 2 weeks. The head of TransCanada itself has said, if we can't build this pipeline, then the expansion of the tar sands is called into question. Yeah, they'll be able to get some oil out of there, but they've only gotten 3% out so far. This is one of these places where we can put the brakes on if we act now.
Let's face it, the way we finance fossil fuel is the heart and soul of much of our political system. You don't have a lot of support in the political world.
Well, this is the richest industry on Earth. That means it's the most politically powerful industry. That's why the U.S. is stood aside. Barack Obama, who theoretically is a good environmentalist, stood aside and, in fact, opened up the Arctic to drilling, opened up huge swaths of offshore America to more oil drilling, opened up the Powder River Basin to more coal mining. These are tough guys to cross. The American Petroleum Institute told the president 2 years ago, you do what we say on Keystone or there'll be political trouble. We'll find out how scared he was.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Miss Stacy Lee, who's going to be talking about turtles, turtle safety, turtle health. Stacy Lee Sherwood, welcome.
Thank you, Richard, for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You know, we rarely have a guest on who has got such a laser-like focus on helping a particular one of our wildlife brethren. Stacy, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in the turtle research.
Well, I've been actively involved in trying to save as many animals and as much of the environment as I possibly can. When I was in college, I got my degree in marketing, and I was going to be a fashion designer of all things. But the marketing and the political science really shaped and focused me in the direction that I have since gone, so thank God for that. So basically, it's just been kind of expanding and taking on more projects as I've started. I started with rescuing animals and dealing with land issues and water quality issues and then climate change. And then I expanded on to getting into the political arena and dealing with the business community. Then I came down to Florida, and I didn't know much about marine life. other than that it was imperiled and that commercial fishing was extremely detrimental. And I went on a turtle walk at Gumbo Limbo, and they pointed to all the lights that were the problem and all the, you know, all the other obstacles that sea turtles face. And I wanted to get involved, and I happened to meet two groups that I now work for. So that's kind of how I got to it. Not very much a straight line, but if you look at the last, you know, few years, it definitely has been a straight line into that.
So you learned about turtles. You learned about the danger from netting. You learned about the danger from lights. What's your focus now?
Well, my focus is a couple of things. I actually work for two different programs. In the morning, I do the statewide morning survey for FWC up in Highland Beach, which is where, if anyone's ever been in Florida or anywhere in the world where they've marked nests, we go out at sunrise and we determine if the crawl is a nest or not, and if it is, we mark it. And then a few days after it hatches, we dig it up and record everything we find, whole eggs, dead, live turtles, whatever. And all of that data goes into the state and then eventually the federal database and determines if a species is, you know, doing well or crashing, if it needs more protection. And then I do that on a volunteer basis. A lot of us that work with sea turtles actually do it on a volunteer basis. And then at night, the other program is with Sea Turtle Oversight Protection, which is down in Broward County, and that primary focus is rescuing hatchlings from disorientation because we have a huge amount of light pollution, just unbelievable. Some beaches, it's almost every nest, and other beaches, like the one I work on, it's like a 50-50 chance that the turtles will go on.
Let me interrupt you for just a second, because I think maybe not everybody in the audience knows how light pollution is a problem for turtles. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I like to actually tell people, because this is something that when it was explained to me, you know, by scientists and biologists, it was very kind of technical and sciencey. But when I'm out on the beach, 99% of people don't speak in those terms. So I try to devise a very simple way to explain it. So I tell people, if you think of the sea turtle hatchlings, their newborns, as light turtles instead of sea turtles, then you understand that they're driven to follow the light. It's almost like they're heroin, like they're crack. Like they come out of the nest and they see the light and they are so driven towards it, you can't steer them away. You have to pick them up and put them in the ocean. But once they're driven towards it, they will go literally to their death, or they'll end up getting caught in the weeds and the dunes or picked off by predators, but it's rarely do they ever all of a sudden turn and go on their own to the ocean. So when they come out of the nest for 100 million years, they're cued to look for not so much light but the open horizon. A lot of people think that they're supposed to look for the full moon, but the full moon only comes out a few nights a month, and hatchlings hatch every night of the month. So they look for the open horizon, which before all of this coastal development, especially down in South Florida, the east side was thick black forest. It was dark. There was nothing there. The east, where the ocean is, was always illuminated with all of the stars because there was no sky glow. Now we have the opposite effect. So when they come out, they're cued to look for that open horizon, which unfortunately is all of the lights on the condos, the chandelier lights inside, the hotel lights, street lights, anyone taking a flash picture, just literally billions of lights, and they're driven towards that, to the ocean.
Thank you. Thanks for explaining that. So I was wondering also, could you tell us what types of turtles make their home on Florida's coast?
Well, Florida is mostly home to three species. We're most known as being very important globally for the loggerhead sea turtle, and then the green sea turtle and the leatherback, which interestingly had never historically nested in Florida until 1996. So occasionally we will get a hawksbill nest, and last year we had a Kemp's Ridley, the most endangered of all sea turtles, nesting up here in Sebastian Inlet. So we might have a few more of the Kemp's and the hawksbills nesting here and just not catch them. You know, if we don't have any live in the nest and we didn't see the mom, We just know that the nest hatched out, but we can't determine exactly what species it is. We get so many nests, we can't keep track of all of them. But those are the three main species. And as far as Florida is concerned, exponentially, especially since 2010, we've had a great increase in loggerheads nesting, which is great. And every year since 1996, we've had a great increase in featherback nesting. There's an ebb and flow between a up and down year, so to speak, but they've been increasing nesting. The problem is that if you just look at Florida, you would think, hey, you know, it's great. Their nesting is increasing. The survivability of the hatchlings going into the ocean is increasing. So that's good. But globally, those species are really crashing, especially the leatherbacks. We could lose them like the elephants and rhinos in 10 years. I mean, we are like at DEFCON 1 here if we don't do something. Plastic and commercial fishing, two biggest problems we face globally. After that would be commercial development, which ties in with not only lake pollution and human traffic on the beach, but also just an erosion of the nesting habitat. So we're looking at some major human impact, not a whole lot of chance that that's going to decrease unless the world really gets behind true conservation and does something about that.
What times of the year are turtle nesting seasons?
Well, that depends on what country, but in Florida we start officially March 1st, so basically in 3 weeks we're going to start. However, there's always an early bird mom. She likes to start things off early somewhere in Florida. Sometimes it's down in Broward County. Sometimes it's up in Juneau. She likes to surprise us. She likes to be the rock star. She likes to get on the beach in February. That's happened almost every year since I've been here. We just kind of happen upon the nest. But basically it starts in March. But most of the leatherbacks nest north of here, up in like the Juneau area, and they mostly nest in April and May. And then between end of April, mid-May, the loggerheads start coming up to nest. They have the longest nesting season in Florida. And then June, July, we have the greenies, which are the warrior turtles. And they nest July and August. Usually by September, we're done. We might have a straggler. Last year, we had some greenies that just wouldn't give up. They kept coming back September, October, and I think one came back in November. She really didn't want to stop. But usually, that's the most impact between April and August is the busy nesting season. And then hatching season usually ends end of October, early November. It's a long season.
Yeah, so I mean, literally half a year or so, huh?
Or even a little more. 8 months. Yeah, 8 months. But then, of course, you have the off season where you try to get condos and hotels to turn off their lights, which is always, you know, like a huge battle. Try to lobby for more protection or just to get the laws enforced, all kinds of things, educating people, recruiting people to help. So it's really a year-round thing. It's not really seasonal.
That's amazing. Is there some train, you know, with the big egg-laying season coming up in March, are there some training sessions people should get involved with early to, if they want to help?
Well, actually, yeah. If there's anyone that lives in Broward County, or I would say the southern part of Palm Beach County or the northern part of Dade, Sea Turtle Oversight Protection covers all of Broward County, and we definitely need help. We have our training class in May, which is kind of like a classroom schooling, and then you go out on the beach, because all of my experience was on the beach. That's basically where I learned. I didn't learn anything, in a classroom, because pictures and lectures, they don't even begin to explain like what goes on. So we have kind of several stages of training, and then whatever beach you live closest to is pretty much the one that you go to, and then you come out, you know, with us, and then we kind of tweak your training because each beach has its own problems. The beach I work on is very wide and pretty dark, private parking, dunes, the people love us. So we don't have a whole lot of problems. We don't have a pier or a boardwalk to deal with. Other beaches do. So each beach is very different. I mean, basically, you know, when the turtles hatch out, if they go to the ocean, you just try to take a count and monitor them like a mama goose. if they're going any other way than the ocean, then you got to scoop them up and take pictures of the light, even if it's just guide little from like Fort Lauderdale, and record all of that. Priority is getting them in the ocean, and then secondary would be the disorientation report, and then, of course, you know, educating people around you. So we would train you on the beach how to do that, which sounds probably very scary and daunting, but I learned to do it, so anyone can learn to do it. The first few times, you're not alone. You're with one of us or probably several people who've done it hundreds and hundreds of times. And then once you feel like you can, you know, you can handle it on your own, then you go sit by a nest. You're never really on the beach alone. There's always staff on the beach, unless it's like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. So the likelihood of some kind of catastrophe is pretty slim. We try to really make sure everyone is confident in what they're doing, because the most important thing is safety of the turtles. And the more confident you are, the more likely you'll less make mistakes. So that training is in May, and we have a website, which is seaturtleop.org, and that's the website you can go to, and you can sign up for a training or a newsletter. And even if you don't live locally and you want to help, there's all kinds of ways that you can help, table at events or donate money or adopt a sea turtle. So there's lots of ways that people can help other than just being on the beach.
When my son was a Boy Scout and I was a troop leader, we went out and helped at a, I guess it was an egg laying on Key Biscayne. And it was a lovely experience. The kids got to see the turtles come out, and of course we kept a very low profile and no lights or anything. But it was a really amazing experience to see one of those wonders of the universe, you know. Is there a census done on the egg layers as well as of the eggs that hatch, et cetera?
I'm sorry, is there a what?
A census done of how many turtles come ashore, where they come ashore, their type of sea turtle that's coming ashore?
Yeah, that's actually the what we call the morning survey. We actually have two different morning survey programs. One is the statewide survey, which I do. One is the index. And that occurs in the morning at sunrise, where we go out, and anytime we see tracks on the beach, we record it. We look at the tracks, and that's how we determine what species it is, because each species has a different flipper movement, different designs that they make, so to speak, and that's how we determine the species. And then we look to see if she nested, which if it's just an unbroken track like a U, then she came on the beach, decided not tonight, and left. And so then we record that as a false crawl. And if it looks like there's a pile of sand over the nest, then we determine that's a nest. And then we put out the stakes with the yellow warning sign, do not disturb. And then hopefully if that hatches out, we record what we find, how many whole eggs, how many hatched eggs. Obviously, if we see disorientation from the night before, we record that as well. Sometimes we have live that are stuck in the nest. They're just kind of, late bloomers. Sometimes they're stuck in the nest and can't get out because there's plastic or fishing lines or weeds, and the little flippers get stuck. So that's a whole other form of rescue that you wouldn't think of. So we record all that information, and that would be the census that you speak of. That goes into the state database, and that's how we can determine if the species is increasing. Also, we look at the false crawls to see if there's any kind of patterns. Like, for instance, if there were a huge amount of false crawls in front of your house and not so much a mile down, I would come out to the beach and I would say, hey, Richard, you got all those white lights on, that you're causing the false crawls. Sometimes it's something that we can't determine, especially if it's in a dark area. There's lots of factors. Sometimes the turtles come up if they're young. Maybe they have the urge to nest, but maybe they're not experienced enough. Maybe all of a sudden it starts to rain and just disorientates them. Could be somebody walking on the beach that disturbs them. So we don't always know. So we record everything to try to look for patterns.
Turtles haven't been protected that long, have they?
Historically, sea turtles were not protected. That's a relatively new thing. The interesting thing with the green sea turtles is the green sea turtles are the ones that people eat for turtle soup. And what happened was, you know, we had a whole abundance of green sea turtles. In fact, if you Google, you know, green sea turtles from Florida 100 years ago, even back in the 40s and 50s, you'll just see these black and white photos of just, you know, piles and piles and piles of these greenies. Some of them are juvenile, some of them are full grown. And it was a big thing to eat, especially down in South Florida and along the Keys, even through the 60s and 70s when they actually got protection. But Florida had actually eaten green sea turtles basically to extinction. They were still swimming in other areas of the world, but they weren't even coming up to Florida to nest anymore. They were just being killed by fishermen. So for 20 years from the 60s to the 80s, the federal government had gone down to the Caribbean, where they nest actually more frequently than in Florida, and taken the fresh eggs and put them in controlled environments, a controlled hatchery, so there was no chance of predators getting them or people or anything else, and then released them into the ocean. So from, say, the 50s and 60s up until the 80s, there was no green sea turtle nesting. And then in the 80s, some of the survivors from the 60s, because it takes about 20 years to mature, started coming back, because they come back to the beaches near where they were born, within a few miles. And they would come back, and they would start to nest. And so ever since the 80s, we've been having an increase in green nesting. So that's absolute proof that conservation works, especially in a very controlled environment. In fact, last year we had an explosion of green nests, like twice as many as we've ever had. It was just really crazy. And the year before, we had a huge record-breaking year of loggerhead nests. So who knows what's going to happen this year? But that was a good example. And green sea turtles were still killed and eaten even after getting federal protection. The problem is these are global species and they migrate all over the place. So even though Florida and the U.S. has them listed as endangered and protected, that's only in our waters. Once they get into international waters, it's game on for anybody. And poaching is just rampant in other places of the world, Costa Rica, Mexico, Tobago. They don't have a light problem. They have a human poaching problem. I mean, the turtles are barely out of the water, and they're, you know, killed for their eggs and their meat. So each place has its own problem. Even though they have international laws, enforcing that is very difficult, and especially because they come up really late at night. So, you know, if you commit a crime at 4 o'clock in the morning, you got plenty at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you got plenty of witnesses. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's nobody on the beach. So you're freer to do whatever you want, and therein lies a lot of the problem. We don't have the manpower to do all of that. And then, of course, if we are more presence, then that also might disturb them and prevent them from nesting. So it's a lack of funding and manpower. It's a lack of public education. But also you have to find a balance between protecting them and not going too much to actually prevent them from doing what they're supposed to do. It's a very difficult situation and very political as well.
Sure. This may be an area outside of your focus, but what have you heard? What's the current thinking on their migratory state? Are they primarily Caribbean based? How do they navigate? How do they know where they're returning? Is it by the stars? Is it geomagnetic? What have you heard? If you're involved in that part of the information,
well. The black sea turtle, which I think is probably more a subspecies of the green sea turtle, is kind of a debate. They primarily are just around Australia. But as far as the leatherback, the loggerhead, and the green, they're pretty much global. They're found almost all parts of the world. The greens are more predominant in the Caribbean as opposed to Florida. The loggerheads predominantly nest in Florida and Oman. But once they leave their nesting beach, they travel all over the world. The first few years of their life, about 4 or 5 years of life, when they're little juveniles, they go out to the weed line, which if you flew over Florida, you kind of see like the kind of like the weed line in the ocean. It's, you know, a few miles off the beach. And they stay there for about 4 or 5 years feeding. And then they travel up north. And then we don't really know a whole lot. A lot of what we know about sea turtles is kind of fluid and changing. We know about when the first fossils were found, and we have an idea that they travel globally, and of course we understand their nesting habits and all of that. But what they actually do in the ocean, because they can live 60, 70 years, we don't know a whole lot about, other than that they travel globally. Then when it comes time, when they hit maturity, which is about 20, and it comes time to mate and nest, they come back to what is called their natal beach. It's not exactly their beach. I mean, a loggerhead that was born in Boca might nest in Highland Beach, which is a couple miles away. Leatherbacks have a much broader range. They might be in Juneau 1 year and down in Highland Beach another, and then down in Fort Lauderdale. Greenies, we think, tend to come closest to their home, but it's within a couple of miles. And that's just something that when they're incubating in the nest, there's something in them that triggers that. I don't actually know the science of what that is called, but that is how they come back. It's almost like a miracle, because humans don't have any kind of capacity like that. Even with a GPS, we couldn't possibly find our way back. You know, I mean, these turtles are swimming all over the world, and it's like, oh, mating season, and they come back within a mile or two of where they were born. You know, most humans get lost, you know, 3 blocks from home. So it's really kind of a miracle seeing these moms come back. And people who've been doing it for, you know, over 20 years, some of those moms coming back might have been babies that they released, you know, 20 years before. So it's where they incubate. It's not where they're released, because once they're out of the nest, they're only crawling on the sand for literally a few minutes. That's not enough time to affect anything. But they incubate in the sand, depending upon the species, 50, 60, 70 days. And that's where they go from yolk and an egg to a fully formed hatchling, which is a perfect little miniature of their parents. And that's where all of that comes from.
Well, Stacy Lee, I want to thank you so much for giving us a real insight into our friends, the turtles, who we share this peninsula with. Thanks again. You want to give that website out for people who want to help?
Yeah, it's seaturtleop.org, and we're also on Facebook, Sea Turtle Oversight Protection. And both the Facebook and the website have videos of what happens when they hatch out and go to the road or the light, so you can actually see within a minute or two what, you know, why we're doing this and what the problem is, and all kinds of links to educational material, how to help. And also you can sign up. The training, like I said, isn't until May, so you can't sign up just yet, but you can send an email and a newsletter, and that will tell you, you know, when it's time to sign up, which will probably be sometime in March or April. And I just wanted to leave with one final thought that anyone who comes to, and this isn't just Broward County, because coastal development is a phenomenon all over the world. So if there's anyone that lives or is visiting on the coast where there are sea turtles, even if the nests aren't marked, it doesn't matter. Sea turtles are nesting. Please don't approach females, because they're very skittish like squirrels. So if you see a turtle, just sit down and watch her. Please don't approach her, because she'll abandon her nesting attempt. No flash photography or white lights. If you have to have a flashlight, use one with a red bulb, because a white light will draw them to you, and basically they'll die in a nutshell. And if you do live on the coast, please either turn off your lights or shield them and close your curtains, because that will help save an endangered species. And wouldn't that be so much better than someone saying, oh, you know, a nest hatched out right in front of your house and they all died in the dune. So we want to leave as least impact as possible.
Thanks so much, Stacy Lee.
Thank you, Richard, for having me.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Stacy Lee, Sherwood, turtle protector, turtle helper, friend of our friends, the sea turtles. Thanks again. And now, I do want to thank our good friend, Shirley Santino, who's provided us with so many wonderful guests. She's been a tremendous help, and this is one more of the guests that she suggested to us. Just a tremendous person. I'm going to now bring on Michelle Garnett McKenzie, Esquire, and she's going to talk about international rights. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Michelle Garnett McKenzie, Esquire, Director of Advocacy, Advocates for Human Rights. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Michelle, could you talk a little bit about your agency?
Sure thing. I work at the Advocates for Human Rights, which is very aptly named. That is what we do. We advocate for human rights, both here in our home community. We're based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but worldwide, really focused on the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and bringing those to life for human beings living today. We work on primarily on ending violence against women and on the rights of refugees, immigrants, and all persons so that we all have access to the things that we need to thrive.
In our contemporary culture, where profit and even boldly spoken or brazenly spoken greed is so important, it seems that human rights and liberty has really taken a back seat.
You know, too often it has, but I am so encouraged to see the demand for principles that really live up to human rights starting to be part of our public policy debate, even if you don't hear the words human rights. When you analyze what the content is, you can start to see it. And one example of that for me, I'm an immigration policy junkie. I love to follow that. It's so important to the lives of our clients here in the work that we do providing asylum services and working with people who are in detention. We see this year in the immigration debate, discussions about what people need, the dignity that they are going to have if there is legalization, a demand from the activists on the ground saying it's not good enough to just legalize as few as people as possible and deport as many. We need to have our families together. We need to have the right to work under just conditions. We need to be able to become fully participating members of the society. This is a human rights framework, and it's really exciting to see that demand.
Well, that's a good perspective, because unfortunately we hear a lot of the other side of that. Here we've got a Democratic president ostensibly who's deported more than anyone else.
True.
Here in Florida with the South American and Caribbean migrants community being what they are, you know, this is not an abstract issue for families that are separated when ICE comes in and does their raids and separates families. This is, at immigration hearings here in Florida, we hear these voices telling those terrible, terrible stories way too often. I want to ask you about an issue that's been raised by a recent news story that's been in the commercial press, the story of the Indian diplomat and her arrest, which really took up the bulk of the oxygen in the news coverage. But let's talk instead about the person who was basically treated as a slave.
Right.
That is a too common story, if I'm not mistaken. Could you talk about that kind of domestic slavery that is hidden too much?
Absolutely. Well, you're right that one of the primary characteristics is the hidden nature of human slavery. But trafficking in persons, you know, we know that slavery is wrong. We have decided to accept under our legal system that slavery is wrong, even though America certainly had the bulk of its economic engine driven by slavery for many years. Today we recognize slavery is wrong, but slavery persists in numbers greater than during the height of the transatlantic slave trade worldwide today. There have been estimated 30 million people involved in slavery, what we define under criminal laws as human trafficking. And the victim of the Indian diplomat's domestic servitude is somebody who's fairly typical in this. We see that trafficking in persons is prevalent in low-wage industries. Top of the list of calls around labor trafficking received by the National Hotline, the National Human Trafficking Hotline in the last 5 years, was domestic work, domestic servitude, followed by restaurant and food services. peddling rings and traveling sales crews, which I think are some interesting interesting dynamics and insight into the way that poor people are exploited in work today. But those domestic workers are so vulnerable because they're inside homes. You know, I don't have any regulatory agencies going into my home and checking out who's working there. So it's very easy to exploit people there. And some of the first cases of trafficking I came across as an immigration lawyer, you know, 15 years ago, of course, I didn't have the vocabulary of trafficking, and we didn't have the law of trafficking to put it in, but they were the servants of diplomats or other, you know, very wealthy folks who come into Minnesota to go to the Mayo Clinic. Right, and those servants had escaped testifying to these horrific conditions. That means, you know, working 24 hours a day, not getting paid, having your documents held by the person who is enslaving you so that you can't leave, perhaps owing money to that person and being forced to be working off a debt either that you have or your family has. All of these things, you know, really prey upon those who are most vulnerable.
We would like to think, many of us, that this is an issue that is confined to the third world or in developing areas. You know, we hear about contractors in Iraq that were using slave labor, or in Saudi Arabia or across the Middle East. We tend to not notice, or at least be oblivious to this, that happens in our country as well, whether we're talking about agricultural workers in the farming communities who basically get paperwork to come over here, and just like the worst kinds of economic oppression, whether their documents are held or they're in fear of their immigration status so they can't report. This is a problem in the United States as well, isn't it?
It is a problem in the United States. You know, as the labor trafficking cases reported during the past 5 years, only about two-thirds of those were referencing foreign nationals, and the rest involved people who were either U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents with no, you know, sort of immigration vulnerability to exploit. This is a problem that's inherent in our economic system, that we're always looking for a way to minimize any cost, and labor is a cost. It's viewed as a fungible commodity, not as a human being. And too often, in these industries that you were just citing, there, you know, workers fall through the cracks. They're either not being, the laws that we have to protect them are not being enforced, or the laws that we have don't even recognize them. One of the things that we've seen over and over again here is the problem with subcontractors. You know, there's a major retailer who hires a contractor to clean the building at night, and they in turn contract with somebody else, and they in turn engage independent contractors who are the cleaners. Well, those folks, under, you know, the typical way that we regulate labor and employment, aren't employees. They're just contractors, right? So they are subject even to minimum wage rules. So, you know, one of the most disturbing things we've been seeing here in Minnesota during the last few years, we've been talking a lot and reporting on how welcoming our state is to all persons, is the fact that wage theft, outright, you know, stealing of labor, making people work for you and not paying them, is at the top of the list of concerns amongst both the, you know, foreign-born folks and the people who have been born here. And I mentioned earlier that peddling rings and traveling sales crews, and that's something that really leapt out at me as getting to the heart of this matter, that people who want to make money off from the labor of others look for those most vulnerable. And a few months ago, we had in one of our major homeless shelters a sales crew coming and putting up recruiting signs all over that shelter. They were, you know, come on, join our sales crew. We'll take you in the van, drive you all around the Midwest, and if you don't make your quota, we'll leave you there. Or once we get you going, you owe us $100 a day for food and clothing and transportation, and you have to pay that off. So people are working and not even making any money under and then taken out of their community where they might have some support and dumped somewhere else. These are people who are born in the United States. It is for all of us to be concerned about.
Another area that I see you're focused on is women's rights and women's human rights. Could you talk about that part of your work?
Absolutely. You know, one of the factors in driving trafficking in persons is trying to make money off the labor or services, the work of someone else, someone who's vulnerable to exploitation. And that is where people who are sex trafficked really are hit hard. Pimp-controlled prostitution is sex trafficking. And we like to think that, you know, it's not. We like to think that there's some sort of, you know, notion of pretty woman out there. It just doesn't exist. Pimp-controlled prostitution is really a criminal enterprise. And the sex industry around that, including commercial front brothels, escort services, delivery services, is really at the top of the list of the sex industry areas that we see sex trafficking in. Of those cases that I was talking about that the National Trafficking Hotline received in the past 5 years, you know, they received more than 5,000 cases of sex trafficking in venues all throughout the sex trade. Pimp-controlled trafficking most commonly, but certainly places like hotels, motels, streets, truck stops, often facilitated online, where an ad was placed on a chat room or a backpage service, an online ordering service where you can go on and buy a woman just like you could buy a pizza or a new tractor, I guess. You know, women accounted for more than 85% of sex trafficking cases. But we also see men, of course, and transgender people who are victims of sex trafficking. The sex trafficking methods, you know, that pimps use, to me, rival the methods that torturers, repressing political dissidents in foreign countries use. I, for years, worked on political asylum cases. My clients would tell me these horrific stories of how they were, you know, imprisoned in order to break their will so that they would do what they were told and so that others would do what they were told. And when I started hearing the women living in my community who'd grown up with me, who could have been me, but for some, you know, good luck and good parenting, and just plain luck, really, I think, you know, they were kidnapped, taken from their community, moved to a different place, sleep deprived, gang raped, beaten, punished when they tried to speak out or get away. Their families were threatened. Family members were harmed. The, you know, one woman I work with quite a bit describes having a gun shoved down her throat, being beaten, having cigarettes put out on her. All of these techniques of violence and control are exactly what we think of as classic torture. And yet, men in this country are perfectly happy and willing to spend millions of dollars a year buying those women and paying the money to those torturers. It's really appalling.
It seems to me that as much progress as we saw, those of us who supported the human rights movements of the 60s and the 70s, as much progress as we saw then, we're seeing, to me, a terrifying degree of backsliding in today's contemporary culture. I'm going to use a phrase that I've heard used popularly. I'm not entirely comfortable with it, but I'm going to say the slutification of broad culture, the sexual nature of too much advertising, and not in a healthy sexual way, but I think in an abusive or an oppressive way. How do you think we can begin to try to turn some of that around?
Well, you bring up a very, very important point that we have normalized violence against women and sexual violence against women in popular culture, and that has to stop. We have, you know, seen simple things actually take some effect. few years ago, a city council member in St. Paul opened up the paper and, you know, to look at the sports scores that his kids were looking at, his teenage boys, and there were sex ads all over the sports pages, you know. And what did he do? He actually called in the paper and talked with the editorial board and explained how this is horrific. His, you know, impressionable teenage boys are looking, you know, who he's encouraging to go look at the sports scores are looking at sex ads right there. And they changed their policy. So there can be simple things where we confront that normalization, each and every one of us, and make some changes and start seeing it for what it is. We have to start seeing human trafficking for what it is, for the slavery and oppression that it engenders. And, you know, every state in the country is subject to federal anti-trafficking laws. Most states have criminal penalties against all of the things that are, in, you know, are kind of in the constellation of trafficking activities, kidnapping or debt bondage or peonage or assault. Use what we have and make prosecutors hold the perpetrators accountable, right? Prosecuting those who are buying sex for as the traffickers that they are, for participating in the trafficking activities they are, is another step. Federal legislation was actually introduced earlier this year to define the person who purchases sex from a child as a sex trafficker. And that's a big step. That is a big step for us from thinking that, you know, that's actually okay. So using our laws, confronting the cultural norms, and then allowing trafficked persons to be protected when they seek help. You know, too often when an undocumented worker speaks out or tries to find help from a trafficking situation, they're deported, not protected. If they're a victim of a serious crime in this country and should receive the protection that they deserve, but we see immigration officials viewing them simply as an illegal alien who needs to be deported and not looking at the labor exploitation they were subject to. And victims of sex trafficking as well should not be prosecuted for prostitution crimes when that is the crime they're a victim of. So really changing that mindset amongst our law enforcement is another step we can take.
Now let me ask you about another, what I'm going to call a crevice in our judicial system when it comes to women's rights and family rights. Often, you know, we hear about women's shelters. Of course, they're typically underfunded and you know, just barely scraping by. But another kind of collateral issue is families, or whether it be women or men or children, who obtain a court order for protection from a violent spouse, and then we find that this restriction, this covenant that they should not be exposed to this violence, that document ultimately isn't enforced. And people who should be in protection or should be protected or are in fact protected by a court order, but in fact they aren't, and people are still killed. How do you think we can address that issue of the unenforced protection of
right.
Court orders that really aren't being followed?
Yeah, it is a tragedy to see the number of women here in this country who are killed by their intimate partners or husbands. We have had a horrible year here in our state with close to 20 women, I think, killed by domestic partners this year alone, or you know, in 2013. The failure of the state to take accountability for that has to be addressed. And partly, I think we have to recognize that it is a challenging job to do because the relationships are dynamic. People, you know, they're individual people, so it's hard to keep track of them. But taking women seriously when they call for help has to be the priority and the training and the mindset of each and every law enforcement officer. Even if there's a situation where somebody lies or, you know, they get manipulated, that's going to happen. You know, there's always a case that we can cite that, you know, somebody did something that wasn't, you know, that undermine the system. We have to really start from the premise that the potential victim is telling the truth. Several years ago in Colorado, Jessica Gonzalez called the police when her husband, against whom there was a protective order, abducted her three daughters. And they didn't pay attention. And the police said, well, it's the dad, and, you know, and they didn't go after him. And they found him in the parking lot of the police department. All three of the girls were killed in the truck. Now, this is a clear failure by the state. And Jessica took her case all the way to the Supreme Court, and he said, no, in fact, it's not. She went a step beyond. She went to the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights and obtained a judgment to acknowledge that, yes, in fact, the state failed in its responsibility. We have to keep doing that, keep holding the law enforcement accountable, and keep calling and supporting our sisters when they make those calls, because it's a hard thing to do.
You're absolutely right. It's difficult. It's complicated. I know myself of situations where, in a situation where unfounded charges were made, the husband is essentially victimized by the legal system when there was no violence perpetrated. So you're right. It's complicated. It's dynamic. But as you say, all due consideration must be given to someone who's saying that they're in danger, and it should be fully investigated, and they should be protected. Absolutely.
Right. There will be renewed conversations this spring in Congress. We're already seeing the preparations for that. We have to make sure that the human, individual, worker, family member is treated with dignity in that equation, that they are, you know, allowed to work, that they are allowed to integrate into the community fully, that they are protected from unscrupulous labor practices, so that when we have immigration reform, that law is really the best it can be for the human beings involved. And we can do that. We have all the tools and really, really, you know, a good starting point, because the community is calling for that. That's the most exciting thing, and that's what keeps me optimistic. But this is not about a bunch of policymakers or policy wonks thinking this up. This is what the people want and need and are demanding.
I lived in South Florida and continued to live there for over 40 years. And one of the immigration problems that I lament every day is in the Caribbean, it seems inescapable that our immigration policies are tainted with racism. We
Yeah.
see the Cuban community, we see the Spanish part of the Caribbean community treated one way, and we see Haitians treated and Jamaicans treated in a completely different way. And I know there's a fig leaf of politics involved with the former Red Scare of Cuba and all that, but I think for those policies to persist so many decades later is really absolutely unconscionable. And I wish I could hear someone else talk about that besides the members of the community, because it's really appalling.
You know, it is. It's one of the starkest examples of racism going on today. And unfortunately, it's so invisible to people, you know, like up here at the northern border, because those folks who are desperately trying to cross the sea and come into our country seeking protection are interdicted on the high seas. You know, we have a exhibit coming through the Twin Cities here in a few weeks on the Guantanamo Memory Project, public memory project that was created recently. And I'll be speaking about the role of Guantanamo in housing Haitians and how we were ready for the Guantanamo Detention Center to be built, because we had used it for so many years to imprison Haitians who should have been permitted to seek and enjoy asylum in this country, but were headed off before they could even make it on our shores. It is also, I think, important to recognize that our asylum policies really do struggle with, you know, with that political cultural overlay that we have. Right now we have a refugee crisis in Central and South America, right? We have seen 35,000 individuals seeking asylum in the past year along our southern border, up from just a few, you know, maybe a seventh of that a year ago. This is not coming out of nowhere. This is coming out of political violence, but it is cast as something that is, you know, really around, you know, just drug violence or gangs or criminal issues, not worthy of asylum. And it's very troubling to get beyond that overlay that we've put on it and really look at the individual circumstance and treat every person with the dignity they deserve and the consideration for their right to seek and enjoy safety and asylum. The Haitian situation, Jamaican situation, is the starkest reminder of that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And let me ask you this. If people want to get more information from you and about these issues, where would they look?
They can look to our website. We're at theadvocatesforhumanrights.org, the whole name, theadvocatesforhumanrights.org. And we'd welcome you stopping by to look at all the information we have on how to really become active on ending human trafficking and on empowering and embracing the immigrant and refugee community in our country today.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Certainly appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Michelle Garrett McKenzie, Esquire, human rights advocate par excellence. And now before I go to our next guest, I want to thank our fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry of Here Be Monsters, who's on the hour just before me, Brian Stetton in his show Progress Toward Democracy, on, I think, Monday nights and Friday nights, Anita Stewart, her Wise Woman Media, also on a Friday night show, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report on weekdays, Monday through Friday, and Sita Bigwheel and her show Sita Media, Harriet Lerman and her show The Voice of the People. So make sure you tune into these other progressive broadcasters. Lots of good progressive thought on the air. Make sure you enjoy it. And if you can, please support us. We're looking for sponsoring opportunities. If you can help the show, we'd sure like to hear from you. And now I do want to bring you Robert Reich, who can, in 2.5 minutes, explain to you exactly what class warfare is all about.
What are they really after? Connect these 7 dots. Number 1, they're against extending unemployment benefits to people who have been out of work for more than 6 months, even though there's still only 1 job for every 3 unemployed. Number 2, they don't want to raise the minimum wage, even though today's federal minimum is 25% below what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation. Number 3, they're against extending Medicaid benefits to millions of low-wage workers. Number 4, they want to cut food stamps. Number 5, they refuse to invest in education or job training. Number 6, they don't want to rebuild America's crumbling infrastructure or have any other jobs program. And number 7, they're out to bust unions. Do you see a pattern here? They're waging a war against the poor and the working class in order to keep people down. Because when you're unemployed, without any support, without any bargaining power, yet you have to feed your family, you're desperate. And when you're desperate, you'll take whatever they are willing to pay you, even if it's next to nothing. And you won't dare make a fuss. You won't complain about unsafe work conditions or toxic chemicals leaking out of storage tanks or anything else. You won't run the risk of trying to form a union. You won't get involved in politics. You won't make a ruckus or rock the boat in any way. You'll take whatever they choose to give you because you are sinking. Make no mistake, this war against the poor and working class is designed to make sure Americans who've been losing ground for 30 years don't dare do anything about it. Without extended unemployment benefits, a declining real minimum wage, no Medicaid, no food stamps, no education, job training, or jobs program, and no union, You'll do exactly as they tell you, and that's fine with them. But it's bad for America. As a first step to stopping this war on the poor and working class, call your senator and demand the Senate pass extended emergency unemployment benefits. As a second step, watch Inequality for All and get the big picture.
That's you. Call Congress. Okay. I got to share you this story. This is one of those under the heading of Turnabout is Fair Play. The U.S. response to a leaked call confirms U.S.-EU regime change plot in the Ukraine. You may have been hearing the stories about unrest in Ukraine. Well, here's a new take on it. Looks like someone applied the old we'd like to spy on everybody approach to some U.S. diplomats, I guess is one way to call it. Washington's response has confirmed the authenticity of a YouTube clip of a leaked telephone conversation between U.S. Secretary, Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt that emerged Thursday. In the call posted by an anonymous Russian source, Nuland and Pyatt discuss installing a new pro-U.S. government that will incorporate the fascist opposition, which has been leading street protests against Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Even though Washington campaign for regime change has been coordinated with the European Union, EU, and particularly with Berlin, in a phone conversation with Pyatt, Nuland attacks the EU for being insufficiently aggressive, saying at one point, hey, fuck the EU. Asked about the leaked video, U.S. State Department spokesman Jen Psaki said, I didn't say it was inauthentic. She added that Nuland was in contact with her EU counterparts and, of course, has apologized for these reported comments. Good for the goose and good for the gander, huh? Oh, by the way, not only has a pro-nuclear governor been elected in Tokyo, but there's been not one, but two earthquakes near Fukushima Friday and Saturday. How about that? But now, our final guest of the night, while you're thinking about that, Mr. David Hoffman, who works on human rights by encouraging independent journalists. This is David Hoffman, and then another guest from our good friend Shirley Santino of Mass Media. Thanks again, Shirley. You're a hero of mine. And here's David Hoffman. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome David Hoffman, author of Citizens Rising and Independent Journalism and the Spread of Democracy, President Emeritus and founder of Internews. David, welcome.
Welcome to you, too. Nice to talk to you, Rick.
My pleasure, sir. I'm very curious. In your work, you've had a commitment to getting the facts out, to getting the news out. I'm sure you've turned to citizen journalism as a movement because clearly the voices that are heard in commercial media do not convey the facts as they are. Could you talk a little bit about how you move from being just a journalist to a citizen journalist?
Well, I myself actually am, I wouldn't call myself a journalist. I mean, I publish in a number of major newspapers and whatnot as an opinion writer, but no, I've actually, through Internews, the organization I started 32 years ago, I have been supporting the training and development of journalists and independent media outlets. I myself am not a journalist, but Internews has moved from basically working with radio and television broadcasters in what we call traditional or old media, and are moving more and more into, programs just like, you know, people like you and programs on the Internet and citizen journalists, and I think that's, the movement of history. Media is moving more and more, what I call the democratization of media. More and more people can now produce and distribute media than ever before, and I think that's I personally think that's a good trend. A lot of professional journalists would disagree with that, but that's my own senses. But ultimately, it's a good thing for us to democratize the media.
Well, my own work has bridged both commercial radio, commercial television, and not-for-profit radio and television, as well as independent production, and I can say that when I worked in commercial radio and commercial television, and even, in fact, public radio and public television, there's an awful lot that's off the table. There's an awful lot that just cannot be discussed. It's deemed inappropriate. It's deemed irrelevant, or at least it's deemed as so confrontational that we just as soon not talk about those things. Let me ask you this. You work with people who are in the alternative news arena. What do you think about, let's say, the short-term future of internet media?
Oh, I think it's, I mean, I think it's just going to keep growing more and more for the reasons that you just said. I think, let me give the good and the bad of it. I think the good of it is that we're going to be covering topics that, as you say, are left out of the mainstream media because the mainstream media has a particular political focus that is inherently conservative. So a lot of topics and a lot of people are not represented through mainstream media. The bad of it is that we're losing the commons. We're losing a sense of sharing our own a common destiny. And we're not talking to each other as much. We're splintering into smaller and smaller niche audiences who are only talking to themselves. I see this also in terms of not just of media, but of communications. And so social media particularly is exacerbating this problem. So we are talking to the people who like us, and we're buying books that are, you know, like people who like this book, like that book. We're going into narrower and narrower audiences. And so I am afraid of losing the political center, which holds societies together. And if we keep splintering, I think we're gonna lose something very valuable.
I think that clearly the internet is a wonderful way of distributing content, and I think in that it's a strength. On the downside, another area that I think is going to really play hell with independent journalism is essentially what was announced as the end of net neutrality. The big footprints are basically going to dial up a web for us where the Disney media, the ABC media, the Google media will be on the fast lane, and everybody else, if you're lucky, if they'll even serve your content, is going to be relegated to the internet boondocks at the lowest possible speed, if at all.
This is something worth being worried about. I mean, you know, you look at the rise of every other media, and they start off being very free, being very grassroots, and then they end up being, you know, consolidated into larger and larger monopolies. And that's a great fear when it comes to the internet and net neutrality.
Now, another arena, since you're clearly thinking about the future of media, another, I have to say, a threat to the media is what we've learned from the Snowden revelations in terms of the ubiquity of the security apparatus through not just the internet, but in basically computer technology in general.
Yes. Oh, it's like an evolution in human history. I'm afraid we can't put that cat. We can't put that cat back in the bag, and it's out there, and it is going to change things. I just wrote a satirical piece. just a couple of days ago, I wrote this satirical piece about, I'll describe it to you, where the deputy director of the National Security Agency becomes the next Snowden. And he's so upset at, you know, what he has done to the world by all this surveillance that he decides that the only way to fix it is to give out all the secrets. So he basically unloads everything the NSA knows to everyone in the world. So we all know each other's secrets, so there's no more privacy at all. There's only transparency. It's both a hellish situation to realize the loss of privacy, but it also, you know, it also has its benefits. And then after writing that, last night I ended up finishing this book called The Circle. I don't know if you know David Egger's book.
No.
But it's a spoof on Google becoming, you know, the next totalitarian system. It goes even further than my own, where there's just total transparency and total lack of privacy, and it's a totalitarian world. It's worth reading.
Yeah, sounds good. You'll have to tell us where that essay of yours is being published so we can take a look at it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's literally being submitted today, so I don't know who's going to take it.
Okay, well, we'll get back in touch with you and find out, and we'll put that up on the site.
Yeah, maybe in a couple of days, I mean.
Where does Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange and Snowden fit in your scheme of media?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the courts are making a distinction, I hope they are, between whistleblowers or leakers, depending on your point of view, and the media that carry their stories. So Julian Assange is going to probably be given some amnesty. At least that's the rumor right now, that it'll be that the United States is going to drop its charges that are pending against him because they determined that he is media, just like the New York Times is media. Whereas Chelsea Manning, as the person who provided the news and was the whistleblower or leaker, depending on your point of view, is not media. And I think that's a proper distinction to make, although, frankly, that kind of begs the question, because I would like to see Chelsea Manning and Snowden, both of them would not be considered media under that definition, exonerated and actually, given the next Nobel Prize.
With Senator Dianne Feinstein wanting to legislate journalistic licenses, I think that the role of citizen journalism and journalism as propounded by the military-industrial complex are going to be increasingly at odds. Because clearly there's a movement afoot to kind of crush all this independent news, these gadflies that would rather, talk about what's really going on than do press releases for starlets.
Yeah, I think any kind of real democracy, whether it's based on the media or based on anything else, is going to be threatening to the status quo. The people in power want to remain in power, and when there is real grassroots alternative power, that could be very threatening. So whether it's China or Iran or the United States, people in power are not going to want anything other than a supportive media. So citizen journalism is going to be kind of inherently threatening and suppressed in one degree or another wherever it occurs.
Let me ask you this. With the commercial news, whether we're talking about the Sunday talk shows or the evening news, basically funded by the Archer Daniels Midlands, the petrochemical industries, the military-industrial complex, is there any hope at all that we can actually get facts and news coverage out of mainstream media?
Well, not through corporate media. No, I don't think there is much hope for that. I mean, I don't want to give up hope. There's certainly there are some enlightened corporations out there. But I'll give you an example. We just got a grant from IKEA to do a program on youth and the needs of children and youth. But when their board realized that it was it had a media component to it, they pulled the grant because media is just too dicey. They're threatened by it. They're afraid of it. Of making any mistake that could hurt their brand. So I think corporate media is always going to be too conservative to cover those things. And what we're going to see though is philanthropic media coming in and doing it. I think this Pierre Amadiar thing with Ben Greenwald is going to be a revelation. It's going to change the media. There's going to be much more investigative journalism coming out through philanthropic media. And then public media like NPR continues to do a really very good job, I think, of doing mainstream news but without the corporate biases that the corporate media are limited by.
Well, I won't argue with you on that. We may disagree a little there.
I knew you would.
Yeah, I hear an awful lot of corporate voices out of NPR and not so much anything left of, let's say, Milwaukee,
I know. That's why I said they're putting out mainstream news without. Yeah, but I think as a whole, they are...
As good as it gets, yeah.
They're reaching a wide audience. And as I said at the beginning of the interview, I'm really worried about the collapse of the censor, which is what happened in the Weimar Republic. led to fascism. I believe we had, I'm bored by left-wing media for the most part because it's too predictable. I know what they're going to say before they say it. I'm appalled by right-wing media, which is, I find, irrelevant. And, you know, it's kind of an alternate universe. And I think what is really important right now is to have media like NPR, which, you know, may have things on there that are more corporatist than you like, but overall they have a balanced approach that I think helps maintain the center. And I think that's, I think there needs to be more of that kind of debate and more of that kind of balance. And you still need right and left-wing media as well. But I don't want to discount that the kind of media that we see in the New York Times or NPR, which I'm often very critical of. And at the same time, I think they play a very vital role in our democracy.
And, you know, you made a comment that sort of surprised me. And you said you were bored by leftist news. I was curious. I don't quite see how that plays when we got a situation where, for example, most of the progressive news stations that I pay attention to offer critiques, for example, of the Wall Street lawlessness or critiques on the disparities between American workers and American executives or criticisms about some militaristic policies, you know, the black sites and the drones and sanctioned torture. Is that what bores you? I mean, what part of that critique troubles you?
No, nothing about that critique troubles me. I just think what I don't like is reading ideological news that's just so predictable that you know what they're going to say. I think there needs to be, you know, I think when I read a piece that both expresses a point of view. And all the points of view you just talked about, I think, are correct and, you know, and are things I'm very interested in. But I think there needs to show enough openness that, you know, that it's the difference between reporting with an open mind and propagandizing your point of view. And when I read, well, it doesn't matter whether it's right,
can you
left,
give me,
right.
For instance, an essayist or a leftist author who you find just way more propaganda? Is that a fair question?
It's not a fair question.
Okay.
I mean, because my brain this early in the morning is not going to come up with one.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking the Amy, Amy Goodman.
Goodman? I love Amy Goodman. I listen to her program all the time. No, I they're great. You know, I help start what is, you know, the most progressive media channel in America, which is Link TV.
Uh-huh.
Which also carries Amy. You know, I mean, I'm a progressive, and I have points of view that are progressive, but the biggest danger in the world is ideology. Whether it's religious ideology or political ideology. Ideology means that you have a closed mind, that you've already got all the answers. And that kind of mind is dangerous. It leads to Stalinism. It leads to religious sectarianism. It leads to most of the wars in the world. And so that's my gripe, is with people who have closed minds and have a set agenda and aren't skeptical. We need to be skeptical. That's the role of the media.
Have you been following the TPP issue, Trans-Pacific Partnership? No. Okay.
No.
The role of Citizen United, which is largely thought of in a electoral sense, I think it has a very strong, and unfortunately, maybe not clearly enough understood role in also shaping political discourse. Because,
tell me more about that. That's interesting.
You know, if you think about it, well, what are they doing? This is basically open the floodgates to political power. And those politicians, those gatekeepers, those preferred voices that come out play a very large role in fact, the range of political discourse. Because those highly funded individuals with their marching orders are essentially defining the American political discussion now.
Yes.
And it's not problem. Enough that they stole the vote. It's not enough that they've essentially said, you know, you who enter here will be the most highly purchased individuals. But essentially, they've defined the discussion.
Yes, I agree with you.
I was wondering, you know, you studied at Johns Hopkins, you studied in Colorado, working on your doctorate. What was it in 82 that set you on this path?
I really go back to 1979, and 1979, the world was really close to spiraling out of control into a nuclear war. If you remember, the Russians had invaded Afghanistan and threatened to cross into Iran. Iran was in the middle of a revolution that was starting then. The Russians had also put SS-70 missiles into East Germany, and NATO responded by moving missiles into West Germany. So they, you know, there was a real threat of conflict there with these short-range missiles. A huge anti-nuclear war movement developed in England and in the Scandinavian countries. China invaded Vietnam. There was just a solidarity happened in Poland. There was just this general crisis. I remember getting a call from Daniel Ellsberg at the time saying that he had learned from sources in the Pentagon that the United States, that Carter was considering placing nuclear landmines on the Iran-Afghanistan border to prevent the Russians from crossing over and taking Iran and then having control of the Straits of Hormuz. So we were very close to a nuclear war. And that is really what got me to originally to write a proposal that an anti-nuclear war movement happened in the United States, as was already happening. It had started that spring in Europe.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. You have undertaken some really interesting projects, and I was wondering, it must have been incredibly difficult to start up or support independent journalists when you've got you know, unrest or war-torn countries or post-war-torn countries. You must have had difficult travel. I'm trying to imagine how one encourages civil society when you are got people recovering from a war effort. Citizen journalism is tough enough in the best of circumstances. In a situation like that, it must have been very, very difficult. How did you pull the resources together to do that sort of thing? And how did you maintain relationships with both governments, you know, of a war-torn country, as well as those who would help, like the UN or the U.S.? You know,
right.
With
well, there are a lot of different aspects to your question there.
Undertake what you can.
Yeah, the first of all, the situation on the ground. In a lot of these countries where you've had none of the media that we're used to, you know, where you have multiple channels. In these countries where you had a single government channel and the people were bombarded with constant propaganda, it was actually pretty easy to introduce good news information because people were so hungry for it that when they saw it, they loved it. For example, in many places of the world, many underdeveloped countries in the world, where we began doing talk radio for the first time, in a country where no one's opinion was ever solicited, where you couldn't even express yourself in the media in any way, to suddenly be able to be on a talk radio program and give your views was just exhilarating for people. So it wasn't hard to get the audience. That was easy. Funding, of course, is always difficult. But after 1989, I think it was, Secretary Baker gave a talk at Charles University in Hungary in which he, for the first time, really said that the United States government should support the development of an independent media. And that opened the spigot for U.S. government funding, and then the Europeans also began to fund it. So
So you had a tenfold increase in funding. Up until then, it was really only George Soros Open Society Institute that funded it. So the funding then began to come from Western democratic governments, and that poured like $1 billion a year into this.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. Right now, let's take, for example, Afghanistan. You know, you've got a government that's sort of partially in control or trying to get full control over the nation. You've got forces like any number of branches of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and you've got American forces, and everybody kind of wants to control their take on the media. I can only imagine how difficult that must be.
It's absolutely fascinating to me. First of all, there is an enormous amount of press freedom in Afghanistan. It is the one sector that's basically working in that country in terms of democracy. I mean, the elections are a sham. There's very little civil society going on, with the one exception that the media has done very well. And so you have, you know, media that we would recognize here as good media, good critical media, and the government has not suppressed it very much. What's really fascinating to me is that the Taliban have allowed these stations to continue. Now, not all the time. We've had people killed, we've had stations burned to the ground by the Taliban, but for the most part, they've left us alone. And I always wonder, why is that? I mean, in Helmand province, and in the most difficult war zones, we have basically free media, free radio that's going on. And the reason is they use the media as much as we do. They get their press releases read out on radio. Their spokesmen are able to be quoted and things like that. So they like it. And my favorite story actually happened in Pakistan in the tribal areas, but it's the same situation. We got a call, our radio station got a call from a Taliban commander who said, you know, I listen to your news program every day, and one thing I ask, is it possible that you could not play the jingle you have before the news program, because I'm not allowed to listen to music, but I love your news program.
Interesting, yeah. Cultural issues. Yeah. David, thank you so much for joining us. I sure appreciate it, and love to talk to you some other time. I want to respect your...
Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a good day, sir.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And as the great master of ceremonies once said...
Now, given the fact of an open investigation, I'm not going to dwell on Mr. Snowden's actions or his motivations. I will say that our nation's defense depends in part on the fidelity of those entrusted with our nation's secrets. If any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy. Moreover, the sensational way in which these disclosures have come out has often shed more heat than light, while revealing methods to our adversaries that could impact our operations in ways that we may not fully understand for years to come.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, it has been your farewell. I'll tell you the next week.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big pool said to push on. All at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where he'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big pool set to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.